is African News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehye Suwuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on African News Tonight.
Quite simply, without widespread vaccination and access to vaccines, this pandemic will not come to an equitable end.
That's Dr. Adrian Thomas, Johnson & Johnson's Vice President for Global Affairs, on an agreement with a South African pharmaceutical firm on distributing a COVID-19 vaccine for sale across the continent. Details coming up. Also, humanitarian aid is arriving in Ethiopia's Tigray region, and a boat carrying mostly children capsizes in Nigeria's Kano State. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. This World AIDS Day, UNAIDS is calling on governments to end inequality so that HIV/AIDS as well as other pandemics can be eradicated. It says new infections are not falling fast enough globally, with 1.5 million new HIV infections last year. Of those, 670,000 occurred in Eastern and Southern Africa. This, by far, the worst impacted region, with adolescent girls and young women being most at risk. Reporter Vicky Stark has more.
From a small town in South Africa, Sadie Brown was diagnosed with HIV when she was 14 years old. Today, she's considered an influencer who works for organizations like UNICEF to help change the narrative of what it means to be a young woman living with HIV.
Once I realized that I was literally not the only person living with HIV, I just felt like, so why are we keeping quiet about it? Let's start a conversation, because keeping quiet also perpetuates the stigma. So I use my social media platform, and over time I kind of cultivated this community of people who were also affected with HIV.
She says she's done a lot of work over the years to heal her mind and heart.
The thing about HIV is that it played a huge role in how I saw myself. My self-esteem kind of took a... Like, I couldn't be myself and think of myself as anything worthy. So my healing stemmed from me getting to a point where I understood that even when living with HIV, life doesn't have to stop.
UNAIDS is a joint United Nations program on HIV/AIDS. Its regional director for Eastern and Southern Africa, Angituku Shongwe, says in 2020 over 300,000 AIDS-related deaths were recorded in the region, while there were 20.6 million people living with HIV, and that every week last year, 4,200 adolescent girls and young women aged 15 to 24 were infected with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa, making them the largest population that is impacted directly. She says they are more than twice as likely to acquire HIV than their male peers.
I mean, there are multiple reasons. The fact that there are such high inequalities in income, as we know, for many young women and girls, they experience violence, you know, high levels of unwanted pregnancy at a young age. And it's intergenerational. It is also transactional. So those remain and have been for decades the drivers of HIV in our region.
She says UNAIDS and the other United Nations agencies emphasize the importance of education to help end the inequalities.
The Education Plus initiative is designed to focus on ensuring that girls complete secondary school, that they have a pathway to an economic activity beyond high school, that they have access to prevention strategies.
But that's not enough. UNAIDS estimates that $29 billion US dollars will be required for the AIDS response in the world's low and middle income countries to get on track to end AIDS as a global public health threat. Gituku Shongwe says the COVID-19 pandemic is having an adverse effect, and if it continues, the consequences could be dire.
Governments had to make choices between funding COVID-19 and funding HIV. So we have seen significant drops in the resources available. So we are off track, and we're talking about that very much. The destruction of services, because services have been directed towards COVID-19. And so in many countries, those drops in treatment, those drops in preventative methods, our data is showing that globally, if efforts are not reinforced at the level at which we need to enforce the treatment, an additional 12 million people could potentially die of AIDS over the next 10 years. So the impact can be measured that way if we were to continue to fall back and really disrupt the treatment agenda in countries.
24-year-old Joyce Omar from Kenya is another young woman living openly with HIV and involved with UNICEF's Y Plus program and holding seats on the Global Fund Board and Youth Council. She says she joins in the call for equality.
And for us as young people, we want to be meaningfully and ethically engaged so that we can be part of the change and we can be part of helping the world resolve some of these issues.
The UNAIDS report entitled Unequal, Unprepared, Under Threat, Why Bold Action Against Inequalities is Needed to End AIDS, Stop COVID-19 and Prepare for Future Pandemics can be found online at www.unaids.org. This is Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
A South African pharmaceutical firm is close to becoming the first in Africa to distribute and price a COVID-19 vaccine for sale across the continent. This will allow Aspen Pharmacare, Africa's biggest drug maker, to significantly boost supplies of the Johnson & Johnson jab on the continent, which has suffered serious shortages of vaccines. U.S.-based J&J announced yesterday it was close to granting a license to Aspen to produce an African COVID-19 vaccine to be called Aspenovac, using drug substance provided by J&J. Darren Taylor reports.
They congratulated one another, using words such as monumental and incredible to describe the agreement between J&J and Aspen. The politicians, international trade officials, and pharmaceutical company executives, such as J&J Vice President for Global Affairs, Dr. Adrian Thomas.
Africa's COVID-19 vaccination rates are significantly lower compared to those seen in high-income countries, and we need to do something differently. Quite simply, without widespread vaccination and access to vaccines, this pandemic will not come to an equitable end.
Scientists and groups fighting for equal access to the jabs blame vaccine manufacturers, including J&J, for this situation. The World Health Organization says only 3% of Africans are fully vaccinated. The WHO attributes this mostly to vaccine inequity. When the jabs were first available, vaccine manufacturers sold most of their stock to richer countries, leaving poorer regions desperately short of shots. Thomas, however, says J&J's always been committed to Africa.
We're delivering on our commitment to make available 900 million doses of our COVID-19 vaccine to the African Union and COVAX facility. Only by working together can we bring together the necessary skills, expertise, and resources to support the vaccination of people who are in most need at this critical stage of the pandemic.
Yet most of the hundreds of millions of J&J vaccines Aspen has filled and finished at its plant at Gqeberha on South Africa's eastern Cape coast have gone to Europe. Nevertheless, says Aspen chief executive Stephen Saad, his firm managed to get significant numbers of jabs to African nations.
If Aspen was not in Africa, would any of these doses have gone to the continent? I think not, with respect. More follow-up booster doses have been administered globally than vaccines across Africa.
Strive Masiyiwa, head of the Africa Vaccine Acquisition Task Team for the African Union, says he was tasked about a year ago with buying at least half of the vaccines expected to be needed on the continent.
That 50% is 450 million people in Africa. We immediately began to engage the global suppliers whose vaccines were showing the most progress.
But, says Masiyiwa, The vaccine manufacturers told him that richer nations had purchased all available jabs and even future stocks.
This problem was those with production assets are the ones who currently control the supply of vaccines.
He says the new deal between Aspen and J&J will give Africa more independence.
Which means when we want to talk about purchasing vaccines, we go to Aspen. We don't go to Johnson & Johnson. It gives us the flexibility. It gives us one of the key things that we have called for, security of supply. I urge Aspen and Johnson & Johnson to complete the commitment, which is that it must include substance production within the next 2 years.
But so far, manufacturers, including J&J, are not prepared to share the recipes for the drug substance or active pharmaceutical ingredients that would enable companies like Aspen to make vaccines from scratch. Only this, say public health experts, will bring the COVID-19 pandemic to a faster end, because it'll kickstart mass worldwide production of vaccines, allowing rapid distribution in less developed regions. Instead, that capacity remains concentrated in a few big pharmaceutical firms who retain control of global supplies and decide where they go. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The World Food Programme, WFP, says 4 convoys of humanitarian aid have arrived in Mekelle, capital of the Tigray region, since November 25th. UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric says 150 trucks have arrived so far, with WFP sending in more daily to meet the overwhelming needs of the 5.2 million people in Tigray who face severe hunger. Meanwhile, Ethiopian government spokesman Legesse Tulu today said government forces have recaptured Rabit after Tigrayan rebels claimed control of the town last week as part of their advance toward the capital Addis Ababa. The French news agency AFP reports that the conflict in Ethiopia has led to mounting alarm among Western nations, particularly the U.S. Washington has been openly critical of Prime Minister Abiy's handling of the war. China and Russia, on the other hand, have been more circumspect. China's top diplomat who is visiting Ethiopia said his country stands against any interference in Ethiopia's domestic affairs. A Libyan court in Benghazi rejected a challenge to the candidacy of retired Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar in the December 24th presidential election. But a court in Al-Zawai ruled him out. An appeals court in Tripoli rejected a challenge to the candidacy of Prime Minister Abdulhamid Dabiba that was filed by the former Interior Minister Fatih Basaga. The Sabah court adjourned a session on an appeal filed by the son of the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, Salif al-Islam Gaddafi, against the High National Elections Committee decision to exclude him from the election after a military force surrounded the court and prevented judges and staff from accessing the building. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi the legal and security challenges facing the election.
The legal and kind of legislative environment around these elections is very unclear. So the legal eligibility for these candidates was only agreed a few weeks ago, and they've been pushing for amendments. Not a lot of those were made. So a lot of things are up in the air. We've now had a very short window. So presidential candidates had to submit their bids towards the end of November. It's just then a 2-week period that the election authority has to process all of the candidates there to get through, and they've been allowed to register all across the country. So what we're now seeing is anyone who opposes different presidential candidates or has an issue with their eligibility is registering appeals against them. Now, what makes this even more complicated is the Libyan judiciary, who is overseeing this process, for a start, is a very, say, opaque entity which hasn't been very active in recent years. So there's a lot of questions over their kind of levels of integrity and accountability and overseeing this process. Additionally, they keep changing the rules. So originally, you could only submit an appeal at where the candidate submitted theirs. So in the case of Haftar, this would only allow appellants to submit this claim in Benghazi, not in Azawia. However, they keep changing the rules and they said then anyone can submit anywhere. So as we've seen with the Zawiya case, we have different rulings from different courts in Libya. We also have different appeals against different candidates who are being ruled out or not. So essentially what we have is a very complicated picture that no one really has a hold on. And against this, what we're seeing is where presidential candidates have been rejected or they may be rejected, their supporters are, you know, very angry about this. Then we've seen protests against elements of the elections. So in short, this is really driving a lot of political uncertainty, political volatility. And with just 3 weeks to go until these elections are meant to take place, it's really not a good basis for free and fair elections to occur.
The Sabha court adjourned a session slated on Sunday to discuss an appeal filed by the son of the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, against a higher National Elections Committee decision to exclude him from the presidential election after a military force surrounded the Sabha court and prevented judges and staff from accessing the building. What's your take on that, given the popular rejection of his candidacy?
Yeah, so what we've seen, again, it's been a lot of kind of mixed reports coming out of SEPA about exactly what has happened. But as you say, that the bottom line is that Saif was initially rejected, and then his lawyers have been trying to get into the court to submit an appeal against his exclusion, but haven't been able to, either because they haven't been physically able to get into the building or because the judges themselves have been prevented or intimidated into not showing up to the hearing, meaning it can't go ahead. You know, this is just showing that actually it's people taking the situation into their own hands. And this isn't just the case with Saif. As I mentioned before, we're seeing this across the country. The rules are very unclear. We've got a lot of powerful actors, whether they're politicians submitting appeals, armed actors on the ground, intimidating or kind of coercing some of the judiciary. So what we have is a system that is very unclear, very open to exploitation and abuse. And unfortunately, I think we're going to see a lot of challenges, therefore, to whatever the end results are, whoever the final list of presidential candidates are. I think there are going to be a lot of people raising question marks over the legitimacy of the process and whether they, that certain candidates should or shouldn't have been included in that.
So could this salvo of legal battles and security challenges lead to postponing the presidential elections, or at least create an environment of rejection of the results if it would be held on time?
So yes, I think we could potentially see a postponement of, so the first round of the presidential elections is due to take place on the 24th of December. However, we saw just in the last few days, the head of HNEC, the Elections Commission, and also UNSMIL saying that actually that 24th of December date wasn't set in stone, and that actually if they couldn't get everything prepared and process the appeals in time, that it may be delayed, so that may be pushed back, and that could also create greater kind of uncertainty about what is happening with the elections. It could be delayed for a long time or just for a few days. I think all of these challenges around the legal environment make it very likely that different parties will reject the result, because unfortunately there are many avenues that someone wanting to challenge the election results could go down, from the original drafting of the House of Representatives presidential and parliamentary election laws. There were many issues with how that was done, to this process of the appeals, the short amount of time that candidates have had. So unfortunately, because there are so many avenues that could be challenged, I do think that we're going to see rejection and challenge of the election results, which ultimately means it, unfortunately, in these conditions, won't create a stable basis for Libya to move forward, which was the whole aim of holding these elections.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi. An overloaded boat carrying dozens of passengers, mostly children, capsized yesterday in northwestern Nigeria's Kano State. Saminu Abdullahi, spokesman for the state's fire service, told the French news agency AFP today that 29 bodies have been recovered, 7 passengers were rescued, and the search continues for 13 people still missing. Abdullahi said the boat was only meant to ferry 12 adults, but the skipper packed the extra children on board. The children were on their way to a town on the other side of the river for a religious ceremony. Both accidents are tragically common on Nigerian waterways, mostly due to overcrowding, bad weather, and lack of maintenance. 2 days ago, DRC's President Felix Tshisekedi gave Uganda permission to pursue the notorious militia group, the Allied Democratic Forces, ADF, on DRC soil. According to the French news agency AFP, yesterday, Ugandan troops entered into the Democratic Republic of Congo to hunt the deadly militia group in a joint operation with DRC units. The ADF historically was a Ugandan rebel coalition whose biggest group comprised Muslims opposed to Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. However, now the ADF, linked by the U.S. to the Islamic State group, is deeply feared in the eastern DRC. A couple of weeks ago, 4 people were killed and 33 wounded in twin suicide bombings in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Police attribute the attack to a domestic terror group linked to the ADF. 5 Zimbabwean refugees face deportation from Botswana after they lost their court bid to stay. The refugees argue they face persecution if they return home. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mukhandisi Dube has the details.
The refugees who arrived in Botswana between 2004 and 2005 took their case to the High Court challenging the Botswana government's decision to repatriate them. The government opposed the refugees' application, saying the matter was brought to court outside the stipulated period. The High Court judge, Michael Liburu, on Tuesday concurred with the state. 4 of the refugees were former soldiers who deserted the army and argue they face treason charges if they return to Zimbabwe. The 5th, Bambanani Ndlovu, was a political activist who opposed then-President Robert Mugabe's rule. Ndlovu described being tortured before he fled Zimbabwe.
We are disappointed about the judgment which happened yesterday. Really, we didn't expect that from a human rights judge, because as it is, some of us, personally myself, I'm a victim of torture. I was severely tortured in Zimbabwe to the fact of losing one of my testicles. And as it is, I'm still wanted for military training in Zimbabwe. A trumped up charge. So I don't even know what will happen to me when I get to Zimbabwe.
He added their hope is now on international organizations to come to their rescue to ensure they do not return home.
We are pleading with you, please save our souls. This is an SOS message. So we are kindly asking for help, people. Please kindly consider helping us in anyhow, even if it means airlifting us from Botswana to a safe area, because Botswana wants to take us back to Zimbabwe. And as everyone knows the situation in Zimbabwe, especially after the court case, they will say, you guys, you've been suing Botswana, you've been bad-naming Botswana, Zimbabwe, we've been incarcerated.
The UN High Commission for Refugees and the Botswana government last year deemed the situation in Zimbabwe as suitable for the return of hundreds of refugees. Most arrived in Botswana in 2008 after fleeing deadly violence in the build-up to the contested presidential election, which the late Mugabe won. While some say they had not voluntarily returned home, Botswana's Minister of Defence, Justice and Security, Kagiso Musi, says the repatriations were consensual.
We believe that returns must be voluntary, safe and dignified. Returns must be based on the right conditions being in place in countries of origin, and returns must be in accordance with international law. We are pleased that almost all the Zimbabwean and Namibian nationals who were previously in Dukwe camp voluntarily returned to their country of origin.
Botswana is home to more than 1,000 refugees who fled conflict in their home countries. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.